Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel avanzado C1. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract zero.
It was no alcohol, out of respect for the different, you know, Buddhist Muslim representations there. So we had Chinese tea. And then at one point, I took my cup of tea and took a big swig and then spat it everywhere. It was whiskey. I looked across the table and there was the rather tall and imposing Russian foreign minister going...
Here, she mimes an ostentatious wink.
Extract one.
There was one time when we were in Papua New Guinea and they presented me with a gift. And of course, pigs are considered to be very valuable assets and also symbols of great wealth in PNG. And if you're given one pig, then that's a statement of your value. Well, they handed me a rope with a huge wild pig on the end of it. And I'm standing there holding the pig, and then they handed me a rope with another pig on the end. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm so proud holding this one. Then the third pig came out. Then they brought out the fourth pig to prove how special Australia was in the eyes of PNG. So I'm holding on to these four pigs. Then they took off. The pigs took off. So I could see my staff thinking their entire lives just flashed before them because I'm going to land down in the mud, and eventually everybody jumped on the pigs and wrestled them.
Extract two.
And I was quite taken aback because John Kerry, the Secretary of State for the United States, started having a go at Sergei Lavrov. Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, weighed in. Boris Johnson was there, and Boris was up the end, and Boris started throwing verbal bombs at Sergei, and the whole thing just descended into a shouting match. And I'll just segue a little bit because it's quite interesting the way this played out. John Kerry accused Russia of announcing that it was going to bomb the rebel-held areas of Aleppo. And Lavrov was outraged and he stormed out.
Extract three.
And it was terribly sad.
Did you have to tell him the news, or he'd already?
No,
got
they
the
knew,
news?
Because this is a couple of days later. They knew, and they were on the edge. They were on the edge. They just didn't think they'd be able to go on.
You've got to offer something in that situation. How do you do that?
Well, I told them what we were doing and said that we would not rest until we retrieved the bodies. That's what they wanted. They wanted the bodies to come home.
Yeah.
And they wanted to be able to have some finality about it.
So you had to make more than 30 of these phone calls. That's a lot of other people's distress and pain to be carrying.
Mm.
Where do you let that out?
I don't know that I ever have.
Extract 4.
I had research done on the Russian ambassador for the United Nations because we needed their vote to get the unanimous resolution. So I knew that he had a family, I knew that he had children. And on the Monday, I called him into our consulate office in New York, and we'd received copies of the Australian newspapers, which had those photographs of all the children and the Muslim kids, and I arranged them on the coffee table as if I'd been reading them. Well, I had been, but I arranged them on the coffee table so that when he came in and sat down, that's what he was confronted with. And I showed him the pictures of the Muslim children, and I said, we have vowed that we will not rest until we get answers for the families of these children. And he started to cry.
Extract 5.
I told them that I would do everything I possibly could, but that there were limits to what we could achieve. And I just assured them that we were in constant contact with their families so that their families knew what we were doing, and I'd pass on messages from their families if necessary. And our consul in Bali at the time, Majel Hines, she was amazing. She also spent a lot of time talking to them and meeting with them and passing on messages from the Australian government. All I could say is we will do everything we can do.
Extract 6.
I felt that I hadn't been able to prevail over an issue that I felt very strongly about. And I grew very close to Retno Marsudi, the Indonesian foreign minister at that time. I mean, she was doing her job, I was doing my job. And I remember having phone calls with her. I was on a train in Europe, and I would ring her to ask if we were making any progress. And she would say, Julie, you know I can't do this. And so we had a very, you know, very strong connection thereafter and to this day.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 0.
It was no alcohol, out of respect for the different, you know, mm-hmm. Buddhist, Muslim representations there. So we had Chinese tea. And then at one point I took my cup of tea and took a big swig and then spat it everywhere. It was whiskey. I looked across the table and there was the rather tall and imposing Russian foreign minister going...
Here she mimes an ostentatious wink.
Extract 1.
There was one time when we were in Papua New Guinea and they presented me with a gift, and of course pigs are considered to be very valuable assets and also symbols of great wealth mm-hmm. in PNG. And if you're given one pig, then that's a statement of your value. Well, they handed me a rope with a huge wild pig on the end of it. And I'm standing there holding the pig, and then they handed me a rope with another pig on the end. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm so proud holding this one. Then the third pig came out. Then they brought out the fourth pig to prove how special Australia was in the eyes of PNG. So I'm holding on to these four pigs. Then they took off. The pigs took off. So I could see my staff thinking their entire life just flashed before them because I'm going to land down in the mud. And eventually everybody jumped on the pigs and wrestled them.
Extract two.
And I was quite taken aback because John Kerry, the Secretary of State for the United States, started having a go at Sergei Lavrov. Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, weighed in. Boris Johnson was there, and Boris was up the end, and Boris started throwing verbal bombs at Sergei. And the whole thing just descended into a shouting match. And I'll just segue a little bit because it's quite interesting the way this played out. John Kerry accused Russia of announcing that it was going to bomb the rebel-held areas of Aleppo. Mm-hmm. And Lavrov was outraged and he stormed out.
Extract three.
And it was terribly sad.
Did you have to tell him the news or he'd already got
the news? No, they knew, because this is a couple of days later, they knew and they were on the edge. They were on the edge. They just didn't think they'd be able to go on.
You've got to offer something in that situation. How do you do that?
Well, I told them what we were doing and said that we would not rest until we retrieved the bodies. That's what they wanted. They wanted the bodies to come home.
Yeah.
And they wanted to be able to have some finality about it.
So you had to make more than 30 of these phone calls. That's a lot of other people's distress and pain to be carrying.
Mm.
Where do you let that out?
I don't know that I ever have.
Extract four.
I had research done on the Russian ambassador for the United Nations because we needed their vote to get the unanimous resolution. So I knew that he had a family. I knew that he had children. And on the Monday, I called him into our consulate office in New York. And we'd received copies of the Australian newspapers, which had those photographs of all the children and the Muslim kids, and I arranged them on the coffee table as if I'd been reading them. Well, I had been, but I arranged them on the coffee table so that when he came in and sat down, that's what he was confronted with. And I showed him the pictures of the Muslim children, and I said, we have vowed that we will not rest until we get answers for the families of these children. And he started to cry.
Extract five.
I told them that I would do everything I possibly could, but that there were limits to what we could achieve. And I just assured them that we were in constant contact with their families so that their families knew what we were doing, and I'd pass on messages from their families if necessary. And our consul in Bali at the time, Majel Hines, she was amazing. She also spent a lot of time talking to them and meeting with them and passing on messages from the Australian government. All I could say is we will do everything we can do.
Extract six.
I felt that I hadn't been able to prevail. It was an issue that I felt very strongly about. And I grew very close to Retno Marsudi, the Indonesian foreign minister at that time. I mean, she was doing her job, I was doing my job. And I remember having phone calls with her. I was on a train in Europe and I would ring her to ask if we were making any progress. And she would say, Julie, you know I can't do this. And so we had a very, very strong connection thereafter and to this day.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 0.
Last year, 189 theatres had to cancel or postpone their Christmas performances. A massive blow because for many theatres, the Panto season makes up around 30% of their yearly income. But already, some venues have cancelled their shows this year, and there are growing fears that the rapid spread of the Omicron variant could spell disaster for local theatres once more. Can theatres survive another winter of COVID cancellations?
Extract 1.
Last year, he said, was far worse.
You know, you go back a year ago and there was literally, you know, one staff member wandering around an empty building, an empty theatre with nobody around, just flushing the taps and, you know, flushing the toilets to make sure that, you know, everything was kept safe. It was really, really sad. A really quiet, empty space that, you know, before that was filled with really happy people.
Extract 2.
It was a similar story for theatres across the country, and the knock-on effects were huge. Theatres play a crucial role in local communities, and they're an essential foundation stone of the creative industries.
It brings people together in towns. It tackles social issues. You know, you might not engage with theatres, but they're still doing a massive job in your community. But also it props up the film and TV industry. So take theatre out of the mix and you won't have Netflix, because those actors didn't learn how to act in their youth theatre and they didn't then go on to make that lovely show and go on to the next thing. So, you know, it's all part of a wider ecology. I mean, theatre, it might not be for everybody, but it massively is the spine, really, of the arts in the UK.
Extract 3.
Can we start with you explaining where pantos fit in with Britain's Christmas traditions?
Well, it's an absolutely essential part of Christmas. I mean, along with carol services, mince pies and the Queen's speech.
Hello, boys and girls.
And often it's a multi-generational experience with whole families going along, grandparents, their children and their grandchildren.
Now, where is Peter Pan?
But in fact, the panto tradition dates back to the 16th century, so it's been around for a very long time, although it didn't really get big until the Victorian era when we started to see huge casts and live animals on stage and special effects and pantos lasting up to 5 hours sometimes. But modern pantos are kind of all those things, but also highly interactive. You have lots of real world gags that appeal to adults.
Extract 4.
This is Davina DeCampo. She's playing Carabosse, the evil fairy Sleeping Beauty.
So it's about having, you know, a laugh and making it accessible. That's the thing about panto, is that it's accessible for everybody, whether you're 100 or whether you're 1.
And the other tradition that's very interesting is that it was pretty risque in the Victorian era. That's when we started seeing gender switching, with the principal boy being played by a woman and the pantomime dame being played by a man.
It's one of those places where it's always been messed around with. You know, the dame is usually played by a man. And that can, now we're seeing more full-time drag performers being included as dames or as the principal boy, you know, which...
Extract 5.
As a performer, what do you most enjoy about pantomime? And conversely, what's the worst bit?
For me, I've been very lucky to play... I'm playing the dame this year. I'm playing Nanny Lola. So the dame is there to warm to everybody and for them to warm to them. But then also I have played Ugly Sister on several occasions and being booed at by a whole theatre of people. There is nothing better in the world. If you can do your job right and get everyone against you, as well as get everybody for you as well, in whichever part you play, then you've done your job right. And it is the most satisfying thing. And the first time I ever did panto, and when we did Oh Yes It Is, Oh No It Isn't, I had tears in my eyes because I was so happy to be doing that at last.
The worst thing I think for me about panto is corpsing on stage, because I just can't stop myself. If somebody does something,
this is what corpsing is.
So if you corpse, you're laughing on stage, and I just can't stop myself. Yeah, very often.
Yeah, that could be the worst thing about panto, Davina's laugh.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 0.
Last year, 189 theatres had to cancel or postpone their Christmas performances. A massive blow, because for many theatres, the panto season makes up around 30% of their yearly income. But already, some venues have cancelled their shows this year, and there are growing fears that the rapid spread of the Omicron variant could spell disaster for local theatres once more. Can theatre survive another winter of COVID cancellations?
Extract 1.
Last year, he said, was far worse.
You know, you go back a year ago and there was literally, you know, one staff member wandering around an empty building, an empty theatre with nobody around, just flushing the taps and, you know, flushing the toilets to make sure that, you know, everything was kept safe. It was really, really sad. A really quiet, empty space that, you know, before that was filled with really happy people.
Extract 2.
It was a similar story for theatres across the country, and the knock-on effects were huge. Theatres play a crucial role in local communities, and they're an essential foundation stone of the creative industries.
It brings people together in towns. It tackles social issues. You know, you might not engage with theatres, but they're still doing a massive job in your community. But also it props up the film and TV industry. So take theatre out of the mix and you won't have Netflix, because those actors didn't learn how to act in their youth theatre, and they didn't then go on to make that lovely show and go on to the next thing. So, you know, it's all part of a wider ecology. I mean, theatre, it might not be for everybody, but it massively is the spine, really, of the arts in the UK.
Extract 3.
Can we start with you explaining where pantos fit in with Britain's Christmas traditions?
Well, it's an absolutely essential part of Christmas. I mean, along with carol services, mince pies and the Queen's speech. Hello, boys and girls! And often it's a multi-generational experience with whole families going along, grandparents, their children and their grandchildren.
Now, where is Peter Pan?
But in fact, the panto tradition dates back to the 16th century, so it's been around for a very long time. Although it didn't really get big until the Victorian era, when we started to see huge casts and live animals on stage and special effects and pantos lasting up to 5 hours sometimes. But modern pantos are kind of all those things, but also highly interactive. You have lots of real-world gags that appeal to adults.
Extract 4.
This is Davina De Campo. She's playing Carabosse, the evil fairy Sleeping Beauty.
So it's about having, you know, a laugh and making it accessible. That's the thing about panto, is that it's accessible for everybody, whether you're 100 or whether you're 1.
And the other tradition that's very interesting is that it was pretty risque in the Victorian era. That's when we started seeing gender switching, with the principal boy being played by a woman and the pantomime dame being played by a man.
It's one of those places where it's always been messed around with. You know, the dame is usually played by a man. And that can, now we're seeing more full-time drag performers being included as dames or as the principal boy, you know, which...
Extract 5.
As a performer, what do you most enjoy about pantomime? And conversely, what's the worst bit?
For me, I've been very lucky to play... I'm playing the dame this year. I'm playing Nanny Lola. So the dame is there to warm to everybody and for them to warm to them. But then also I have played Ugly Sister on several occasions, and being booed at by a whole theatre of people, there is nothing better in the world. If you can do your job right and get everyone against you, as well as get everybody for you as well, in whichever part you play, then you've done your job right. And it's the most satisfying thing. And the first time I ever did panto, and when we did Oh Yes It Is, Oh No It Isn't, I had tears in my eyes because I was so happy to be doing that at last.
The worst thing I think for me about panto is corpsing on stage, because I just can't stop myself. If somebody does something,
what corpsing is.
So if you corpse, you're laughing on stage, and I just can't stop myself.
Yeah, very often.
Yeah, that could be the worst thing about panto, Davina's laugh.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Este es el final de la tarea 2. Tarea 3. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
I'm brushing the top of my crab with agave nectar, which is basically like a vegan version of honey.
Never did one simple line end up causing such confusion and such disagreement. That was the voice of 19-year-old Freya Cox, who became the first ever vegan to compete in the Great British Bake Off. And her vegan baking style and use of alternative ingredients captured people's attention and sparked conversations about plant-based diets and what they're all about, particularly around the use of honey. So joining us to talk more about this are Colette O'Connell, PRO of the Irish Beekeepers Association, and James O'Donovan, co-editor of Vegan Sustainability magazine. Very good morning to both of you. James, can I start with you first? How is honey not vegan? The bees don't die after all, do they?
Well, ethical veganism is a philosophical belief system based on the understanding that animals are sentient, and so we shouldn't hurt or harm them. So it's about not interfering with the life cycles of other species. And so ethical vegans don't use any products that come from animals. They don't use leather. They don't eat meat or fish or other products. So it also includes vegans don't eat honey.
But doesn't beekeeping actually sustain bees during the course of the winter by feeding them at a time that they're dying off? If anything, it's nurturing them.
In Ireland, there's 98 different species of bees. So we have the familiar honeybee, and then there's 97 wild species. And a third of our 97 wild bees are threatened. And so managing hives does nothing to protect our wild pollinators. So the honeybee is not endangered. So it's kind of like farming chickens to save wild birds. And keeping honeybees may be detrimental to our wild pollinators, because when each bee hive has about 50,000 bees. So if somebody has 10 hives, that's 500,000 bees in a particular area. So there may be some, they may be out-competing our wild pollinators, who are the ones that need protection.
So, Colette O'Connell, do you think that that's the case, that honeybees are actually introducing extra competition for food for our native solitary bee bees?
Not at all, Philip. Good morning to you. The Irish Beekeepers Association and our members have central to our ethos the support of the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan. Anything that promotes our native pollinating insects promotes our honeybees. We very much want to protect the environment for our bees and for native pollinating insects. And I can just even just throw out the fact that last year during COVID and lockdown, our members planted 4,000 plus native pollinator bee-friendly trees thanks to the help of Quilta, and we did this during lockdown. We very much want to promote the environment and keep it good for all species, including our native.
Okay, but without that planting, without that creation of extra sources of pollen, would it be the case that honeybees would be competing for food with solitary bees?
Not necessarily, because if you look at the different species of bees there, they have different requirements, and bumblebees will work plants that honeybees can't because of the difference in length of their proboscis, which is a straw-like body part that they use to suck up nectar. So different times of the year, you'll have different plants worked, and our hedge grows are a multi-source of food for all pollinators, insects and wildlife.
And how do you feel about the suggestion coming from veganism that you are exploiting these animals?
Well, can I say, in Ireland, there isn't industrial beekeeping. We have commercial beekeepers who do beekeeping on a full-time basis. But in Ireland, like, we love our bees. We have to mind them.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
I'm brushing the top of my crab with agave nectar, which is basically like a vegan version of honey.
Never did one simple line end up causing such confusion and such disagreement. That was the voice of 19-year-old Freya Cox, who became the first ever vegan to compete in the Great British Bake Off. And her vegan baking style and use of alternative ingredients captured people's attention and sparked conversations about plant-based diets and what they're all about, particularly around the use of honey. So joining us to talk more about this are Colette O'Connell, PRO of the Irish Beekeepers Association, and James O'Donovan, co-editor of Vegan Sustainability magazine. Very good morning to both of you. James, can I start with you first? How is honey not vegan? The bees don't die after all, do they?
Well, ethical veganism is a philosophical belief system based on the understanding that animals are sentient and so we shouldn't hurt or harm them. So it's about not interfering with the life cycles of other species. And so ethical vegans don't use any products that come from animals. They don't use leather, they don't eat meat or fish or other products. So it also includes vegans don't eat honey.
But doesn't beekeeping actually sustain bees during the course of the winter by feeding them at a time that they're dying off? If anything, it's nurturing them.
In Ireland, there's 98 different species of bees. So we have the familiar honeybee. And then there's 97 wild species. And a third of our 97 wild bees are threatened. And so managing hives does nothing to protect our wild pollinators. So the honeybee is not endangered. So it's kind of like farming chickens to save wild birds. And keeping honeybees may be detrimental to our wild pollinators, because each bee hive has about 50,000 bees. So if somebody has 10 hives, that's 500,000 bees in a particular area. So there may be some, they may be outcompeting our wild pollinators, who are the ones that need protection.
So Colette O'Connell, do you think that that's the case, that honeybees are actually introducing extra competition for food for our native solitary bee bees?
Not at all, Philip. Good morning to you. The Irish Beekeepers Association and our members have central to our ethos the support of the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan. Anything that promotes our native pollinating insects promotes our honeybees. We very much want to protect the environment for our bees and for native pollinating insects. And I can just throw out the fact that last year during COVID and lockdown, our members planted 4,000 plus native pollinator bee-friendly trees thanks to the help of Quilta, and we did this during lockdown. We very much want to promote the environment and keep it good for all species, including our native.
Okay, but without that planting, without that creation of extra sources of pollen, would it be the case that honeybees would be competing for food with solitary bees?
Not necessarily, because if you look at the different species of bees there, they have different requirements. And bumblebees will work plants that honeybees can't because of the difference in length of their proboscis, which is a straw-like mm-hmm. body part that they use to suck up nectar. So different times of the year, you'll have different plants worked. And our hedge grows are a multi-source of food for all pollinators, insects and wildlife.
And how do you feel about the suggestion coming from veganism that you are exploiting these animals?
Well, can I say, in Ireland, there isn't industrial beekeeping. We have commercial beekeepers who do beekeeping on a full-time basis. But in Ireland, like, we love our bees. We have to mind them.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Este es el final de la tarea 3. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.